Well, and all the talk about work rules, what about finding work that is meaningful? That's a search that author Wes Moore has been thinking a lot about. He's probably best known for his 2010 book, The Other Wes Moore, which told the story of how he went through a difficult childhood as an African-American son of a single mother in Baltimore, ditching school, getting in trouble with the police. But he managed to turn his life around, while another man from the same neighborhood and with the same name ended up serving a life sentence for murder. In his new book, Wes Moore talks about the many journeys and jobs he's had since then. He went from Oxford to the White House, from Wall Street to Afghanistan. His book is called The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Wes Moore, I want to sort of approach this interview as if I'm interviewing somebody who might one day be the president of the United States, because as I'm reading this and I'm looking at you, a Rhodes Scholar, you've served in the military, you've interned in all
these different— I thought we were friends. Why would you ever wish that upon me?
Well, let me ask you, though, about something that you start with here, and that is you're arriving in Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar. You're 23 years old. This is right after 9/11. How did that event, 9/11, and being abroad right afterwards, shape your view of the United States?
You know, I think there were really two things that genuinely happened. One is you have a much greater appreciation for your country, for its path, for its destiny, for the fact that we are one of the most remarkable experiments in human history. And with every year, we hope that we continue to perfect our union. But at the same time, you also— – one of the big takeaways is that, you know, the U.S. does not have the market cornered on good ideas. That people all over the globe not only have challenges that they're addressing, but they have opportunities that they're seizing. And I think it's wise of us to be able to think about, as these things are presenting themselves, that we have the context and the perspective of not just our own perspective, but the context and the perspectives of others that help to inform our decisions.
What are you thinking of when you tell me that? Is there a specific example you're thinking of where we don't have— the rest of the world has some idea that we don't have?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for everything from the way we think about energy to the way that we think about, you know, service and employment to the way we think about the college transition, you know, I think, for example, you look at the, you know, some things that are happening right now with Europe and the way they think about higher ed, you know, part of the frustration that I think that I see within the systems that we have right now is we have such siloed systems in the way that we think about education in this country, where you have the K-12 and then you have higher ed and then you have, you know, the post-secondary. But we don't have those same kind of bridges that are able to translate how those things work. And I think if we're able to look at things from that realm, we realize how quickly those national boundaries tend to dissolve.
One of the other things you talk about in this book, especially when talking about living abroad, is code switching, which is something that you say you learned early on growing up in Baltimore in order to blend in with both kids in the neighborhood that you grew up with, as well as some more privileged kids perhaps that you went to school with, and that you then had to do that again when you were an African-American living abroad.
Yes. And you know, it's amazing because it's one of these things that you realize that you're doing without even realizing that you're doing it. Where the way that you talk, the way that you carry yourself, the things that you'll say, the things that you'll even think might happen to change based on the environment that you're in. And now part of it is a basic survival technique, right? I mean, you know, part of it isn't necessarily I want to fit in better here, fit in better there. Part of it does come down to the fact that if you want to, you know, keep your sense of self as to where you are, these are just some basic things that you have to do. You know,
like what?
At the same time. So for example, I mean, you know, you can even look at some basic examples like, you know, the way I talk to my friends is not the way that I talk to my grandmother, right? I mean, the words that I would use, the way you react to certain things. One thing I saw when I was going to school, I was living, at that time, living in the Bronx. And my mother had was working three jobs because she did not feel comfortable with the school that I was going to in New York. So she then sent me away to a private school across town on the other side of the Bronx. And I very quickly found myself being, you know, too poor. And then I very quickly found myself being too rich for the kids in my neighborhood who now didn't understand why the schools that, you know, that everyone else attended was somehow, you know, quote unquote, not good enough for me. And so what you do is you almost become this chameleon. The danger of it is that you then find yourself not even understanding who you are.
Well, when it comes to understanding who you are, and as you are switching over the course of all these experiences, you're going from internship to the military to Rhodes Scholarship to a job on Wall Street to whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Did you – were you able ever to answer that question, you know, what do you want to be in 5 years during all of that? Or did you just sort of go with the flow?
Well, I think part of it was that I had to actually start to think differently about even how you answer that question. Do you know? Because I think part of the challenge that I even had when I was coming up, and I think a lot of kids have this problem, is you don't think long term. You know, I remember one experience where I was with one of my mentors from the Johns Hopkins University, the former president. And when I told him I was going back to Wall Street, and I was, you know, I was excited because I thought he'd be excited about this job I'd have working in finance. And his response was, "Really?"
Yeah.
And I was kind of taken back by his reaction. And he said, he asked me why I wanted to do it. And I explained to him that, you know, I wanted to build a skill set and, you know, I wanted to support my family and do all these things that my family never had a chance to do. And he kind of stopped me and he said, "Listen, Wes, you know, I guess I understand I'm never going to, you know, cast judgment on you as to the decisions you make. But the only thing I ask is that once you feel like you have accomplished everything that you need to accomplish there, you need to leave. Because if you're doing something that is not what you're supposed to be doing, then with every day longer you stay, you become extraordinarily ordinary." And when he said that, it really hit me, because as you think about what it is that you're supposed to accomplish and how do you think about your life, the goal is never to be extraordinarily ordinary. The goal is to capture what it is that makes you special.
If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Wes Moore about his new book, The Work. And Wes Moore, you've had a lot of mentors throughout your life. And the one that you speak really eloquently about in this book is your grandfather, who
Yes.
passed away and you were in Afghanistan and were not able to make it back in time. But tell us what he meant to you. You write here, "My father had been my Moses, bringing me to life. Then my grandfather became my Joshua, carrying me through my childhood and teen years into adulthood."
He was one of the most important people in my life, and actually one of my great disappointments in my life is that I didn't see it or appreciate it until I got older. This was a man who was actually born inside the United States, was born in South Carolina, and when he was just 4 years old, 5 years old, the Ku Klux Klan actually ran the family out of not just South Carolina, but out of the United States, and they moved to Jamaica. And his father was a minister. He later on became a minister as well. In fact, he became the first black minister in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church. And the thing that I so admired and still do admire about him was he was so confident and certain about who he was. He knew he was here for the ministry. He knew that he had his calling, and that was the calling he was going to follow. And it wasn't something that came with heavy prestige. It wasn't something that came with large paychecks. But it was something where he was fulfilling what it is that he was supposed to do.
And why do you say you didn't see or appreciate what he brought when you were young?
Because I think when I was coming up, I was also just a very angry kid when I was coming up. You know, I only have two memories of my father. And the second one was when I was about 4 years old, when I watched him die in front of me. And I think that I didn't fully understand what that meant until I started getting older. And when I got older, I found myself just, you know, hurting people that truly did love me so I could impress people that could care less about me. You know, picking and choosing which days were worthwhile to go to school. On academic and disciplinary probation by the time I was 8 and 9 years old, and when I was 11, was the first time that I felt handcuffs on my wrists. So I think that I had some wonderful people around me, but the more they pushed, the more I pulled. It took me to really grow up and to understand what it means, and not just to be an adult, but what it is to really be a person that my family could be proud of.
What has he taught you about what you want to be for your grandkids?
I think he's taught me that the most important thing that you can do is simply to be present, not just physically present, but fully present for them. That your example matters. Being a person of not just faith, but being a person of conviction. The most important question that anyone will ever ask you, and that my grandfather asked me, was, who will you fight for? You know, who will you stand for and stand with when it's not easy or when it's not popular? Who will you advocate for when it's not convenient? Who will you stand shoulder to shoulder with when it might just be you too? But you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And I think so much of finding your work and finding where your greatest joys and passions overlap with the world's greatest needs and you choose to do something about it is answering that exact question. Who will you stand for? Because when you find that, you will find your greatest joy and you'll find your point of being here in the first place.
Wes Moore, before I let you go, I want to just ask you a couple of quick lightning round questions, just in case you ever do run for president, and then we'll be able to go back and listen to the answers.
You got it.
Well, you're an Afghanistan veteran. Do you think that that war was a good idea?
I think that the response to Afghanistan was a good idea because whenever you have – you cannot have a state that is openly and willingly harboring those who are actively attacking your nation and not have a response. I think, though, the response that we had to it, and especially the response that we had to the later war, Iraq, was part of the problem, part of the erosion of not just the operations, but also the civil conversation about it as well.
Do you think Wall Street, and you've got some complex views on Wall Street in this book, do you think that in general today it is doing more good or bad for Americans?
I think that adding liquidity to the financial system is useful, but I think we need to have much more restraints and barriers as to what that means and what it looks like. I think that if you look at some of the things that caused 2008 to happen, the fact that we still have not had a collective response to it, the fact that we have not had an honest, large-scale conversation about what caused it, and the fact that we still have a lot of things in place that led to a lot of these things that still have yet to be addressed is a fundamental problem, not just the way that Wall Street works, but the way our larger economic system works.
Who's your favorite president?
My favorite president is Lyndon Johnson, and I say that because
he's the creator of public broadcasting.
He's the creator of public broadcasting. The first thing I was going to say. The second thing that I was going to say is when you look at the large scale ideas of progress, you know, and you look at Lyndon Johnson, also I'll throw Harry Truman on there as well. Some of the most longstanding and important national initiatives and long lasting national initiatives have come under those presidents. And another reason why I say LBJ is I don't know if we've seen an evolution of a president so stark as we've seen of LBJ. You know, who LBJ was when he was in the Senate eventually became a very different man than he was when he went to the White House. And oftentimes, there's almost this pride of saying, well, I said this 45 years ago and I say the same thing now, which I never quite understand because, you know, when a new information is introduced, it's completely understandable that your views can evolve. And I think LBJ was someone who symbolized that as new information was introduced, particularly around things like, you know, income disparity, housing, and civil rights, his views evolved. And I respect that.
What's the biggest problem facing the U.S. today?
I think there's a lot of gaps that we have, right? We have education gaps. We have digital gaps. We have housing gaps. I honestly think that the most dangerous gap we have in our society is the expectation gap. I think we just expect different things from different people, and that's amazingly dangerous. You know, I go back to a conversation I had with the other Wes Moore, the person I wrote about in the first book, who's currently spending – he's now in year 14 of a life sentence in prison.
This is somebody else who is also named Wes Moore.
Who
also grew up in Baltimore, right?
Exactly. Grew up in Baltimore. Both grew up in single-parent households. Both grew up with academic and disciplinary troubles. And around the same time that I was receiving the Rhodes Scholarship, he was also being sentenced for a life sentence in prison for the murder of a police officer. And I remember asking him once when I went to go visit him in prison, and I said, do you think that we're products of our environments? Because I'd always grown up with this idea that we are products of our environments. And he said something to me that day that I will never forget. He said, actually, I think we're products of our expectations. And as soon as he said it, I thought to myself, he is absolutely right. Because the expectations that people have of themselves come from the expectations that other people have of them. And someone once said to me, it said, it's a real shame that you lived up to your expectations and Wes didn't. And I said, actually, the real shame is that we both did. So I think one of the most dangerous things that we have in our society and one of the biggest challenges we've got to address is this expectation gap that we have of our citizenry.
Wes Moore, his book is The Work, My Search for a Life That Matters. Do you have any idea what you're going to run for first?
PTA president.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's what I want.
No, that's great. Wes Moore, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.